Hello and welcome to Bicycle Talk. It's July 6, 2016. My name is Ron Meniza and I am here with my co-host Fran Storch. This is a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar, not always in that order. Anyway, one of the big things that's going on right now, and this is a really big thing, is what, Fran? What's going on right now? What's the most exciting thing going on right now in bicycles?
The Tour de France!
Hey, there we go. There we go. Yes, it's time for the Tour de France. It is. It started on July 2nd this year, and a little bit of a different format this year, which is kind of interesting. And I'm not sure exactly why it was changed, but I know they did have some problems in previous years with cobbled roads early into the tour. There were some concerns about safety, I think, and so they made a few changes in the tour this year. So anyway, the Tour de France is on and it is alive and well. And of course, as always, the first few stages of the tour are going to be flatter and oriented more towards people who can sprint. So it's been extremely exciting. The finishes are great. And this year we have had a couple of days in a row that there have been photo finishes. And I mean photo finishes. Just there's no way you could possibly have picked the winner of the race without a camera. And they were 1/1000th of a second apart on one day. I mean, it's incredible. It's crazy stuff, crazy, crazy stuff. But anyway, backing up the Tour de France. Tour de France is, for those of you who are not aware of this, the number one most watched athletic event in the world. Yeah, sorry, NASCAR fans. Sorry, baseball. Sorry, football.
But NASCAR is the most watched sport in the U.S., right?
That is correct.
Okay.
Well, at last I looked, yes, it was. So I'm sorry about all you other folks that love all these other sports, and that's wonderful and all. And you should always have a sport that you love. It's kind of fun. It makes it life exciting. But yeah, it's bicycle racing, and it's the Tour de France. And the reason it is the most watched sport in the world is because it's free. Think about this, okay? You're not paying admission to this. It's not in an arena. And now let me give you the number two sport, because the number two sport most worldwide is soccer, or what the rest of the world calls football. So that also has a very, very large spectator activity involved with it, both broadcast and also actually there at the arenas. But the Tour de France, or any bicycle races out there, any of the grand tours, the Tour of Italy, the Tour de France, the Tour of Spain, all of those are able to be watched by just standing on the roadside and watching it go by. So there is an element of it's free, so I'm going to go watch the bike race. Really cool thing. And that's why it attracts so many people, because they can just watch freely. The other thing it does, just like any sporting event, it does tend to attract a bit of a party atmosphere, and people will actually get to a particular point along the course a lot earlier than the race is going off, and they will begin their tailgate, and they will sometimes they ride to that point because they're also avid cyclists and they really like to ride their bikes there and get all charged up and wait for the pros to come through. And then others you'll see along the edge of the road, you'll see these campers, and they are, you know, they're just all decked out. They've got the grills going. They're just, you know, they're doing the tailgate, and they're going from day to day to day. They're following the tour along the way. So they actually travel along with the tour. It's kind of a neat thing. And again, one of the most watched events in the world. So the Tour de France, of course, is the big one. It probably just because it has more publicity than anything else. The French have been big behind it for many, many years. It was first, I believe it was first endorsed by a newspaper in France, which is where the, and so they used it as a way to actually build their readership by having this bicycle race based around it. So that way people would pick up the paper every day and they would read the paper. Remember papers? Remember people used to read papers? Well, things are a little bit different now than they were then, but they're still, you know, it still happens. So anyway, it has been very, very exciting for those of you who are into bicycle racing. Unfortunately, one of the major contenders of the race has had a couple of very bad days, and he has fallen down a couple of times because bicycle racing is dangerous, folks. And Alberto Contador is already a couple of minutes behind everyone else because he had 2 days in a row that he crashed hard, and which is really unfortunate. But so he's 2 minutes down, but that is like nothing compared to what he can make up when they get into the big climbs, because he is well known as a great climber. And that's when things really change. So there's a different part of France that they're using called the Massif Central of France. And it's a different region, and the hills are not as big. It throws a different element into it, and that is going to be, they're saying that it could really change the format of the and the rhythm of the race because of it, because it's a little bit different to work with. So we'll see what happens. They're going to start by going in there. I believe today's stage goes there, and I don't want any spoilers, so please don't call me and tell me how it all went. I'll look tonight when I get home. Thank you. But they had a couple of small climbs. There were some Category 2 climbs. There was Category 3 climbs. The climbs are actually categorized by their difficulty. And anyway, so they're mixing it up with some shorter, steep climbs that are difficult. But they will break up the race a bit, which is kind of cool. That's what makes the race the race. So there's going to be some interesting things going on today. I kind of can't wait to see the results at the end of the day, and I will. And so that will be a really nice thing. The sprinters, this is where things get tough for the sprinters, because when they get to the hills, they're bigger people. They carry a lot of extra body weight with them. They're very large in the legs, and also they tend to have larger torsos. They're not your typical Grand Tour looking rider. The Grand Tour looking rider looks more like a marathon runner. They're very leggy. They have very, very strong legs, but they tend to be thinner, and they tend to have much smaller upper bodies because they have to carry all that up the hills. And any of you out there that are listening that ride a bicycle, which I hope that there's a lot of you out there that are listening that ride a bicycle, know what it's like to climb a hill. And when you get to the hill and you've got a little extra weight, it makes it a whole lot harder to get over the hill than it does when you're a little bit lighter. So consequently, what happens is as we get more developed in our season and we start to get a better level of fitness, we find that we can climb the hills a little bit better than we could previously. So your earlier times of the year are more of a struggle as you're getting fit and you're still carrying maybe a little extra winter weight. And then when you get to be about this time of year, things start feeling pretty good, which is nice, which is really, really nice. The one thing you have to remember is that if you are out on a group ride with a bunch of your friends and buddies, and the format of the group ride is to be a friendly type of affair, you do have to remember to, even though you're feeling that extra fitness, to still ride with your group and be responsible to your group. Try not to drop anyone or prove anything to them. If you want to do that, there's places for that. There's plenty of places for that. So anyway, not since 1992 has the Tour de France climbed so early into the race. So this is early for them. They usually do, you know, probably 8 days or more of flat racing, which is very exciting. They come into these little towns and they have these big sprints and, you know, lots of people line the streets. And again, the party continues there too. But this year they decided to do something a little bit different. And they also did not use the opening prologue time trial this year, which is very, very interesting because it almost always starts with an individual time trial. For those of you who are not cycling, oriented. The time trial is a race against the clock. You do not race against anyone else. You just race against the clock. And of course, the fastest, you are actually racing against other people, because your time being the fastest time would be the winning time, or not, depending on your performance that day. But you are simply going against the elements in front of you. And most time trials are flat, but they also have uphill time trials too, that are point, and most of them are point to point. So that's the way that usually works. And it is known in the cycling world as the race of truth. And why is it the race of truth? Because there's no lying about it. It's you, and it's your bike, and it's the clock, and that's what you have to work with. So they usually open up with a time trial, and then that's kind of sets up the leader's jersey. And this year they decided not to do that, which I thought was really interesting, because it's the first time I've seen that in a really, really long time. So he brought back an opening sprint stage this year, the race director, which is kind of cool. And it's, so there's a big race, there's a big pack, and they ride for many, many miles, and then they ride into a small town at the end, and they sprint for the finish. Another thing that a lot of people don't understand about the Tour de France, or any of these grand tours, and the way they all work, obviously money has to drive all these, because this is a very expensive affair to put on. You're closing off roads, you've got traffic control, you've got a lot of expense that goes along with it. The beginning of the tour, when this tour starts, there is a parade of a caravan of vehicles that are all advertisers. They all go off hours before the actual start of the bike race. So all these people that are out lining the roads on the tour are standing there, and they're waiting for the tour to come through. But then there's this caravan of advertisers that are going through, and they're throwing out free goodies and, you know, little what we call swag, right? Swag. And what is swag, Fran?
Swag. It's actually SWAG, and it's just an acronym that means stuff we all get.
That's it. Stuff we all get. So anyway, they're throwing out all sorts of fun stuff, and it could be pens or pencils, or it could be hats or T-shirts or whatever, but they basically litter the course with that, and the people who are watching the race pick all this stuff up. And my neighbors came back a number of years ago, and they brought me back a hat, and they brought me back a flag and some other cool stuff that they had picked up along the way, and they thought I would really like this. So it was very cool. It was very, very nice of them. So anyway, that goes on for hours before the race even comes through, and then after that comes the race. So they all get through, and then they park their vehicles, and then the way that the towns are laid out, the way that the race course goes, a lot of the towns bid to have the race come through their town. So if you want the race to come through your town, you raise a whole bunch of money and you say, look, you know, we're going to give you $50,000, we want to make sure you come through our town. I'm just picking a number here. There probably is a lot more than this. But we're going to give you $50,000 so you'll come through our town, because if you come through our town, then all these spectators will come to our town, and they'll don our cafes and our shops. And so, you know, money will be brought into the community because of that. Because after the race goes through, what do? So you sit, you eat, you shop, you do different things like that. So it's a way to bring revenue into your town and recognition to your town too. So, and when you had the finishing sprint coming in, of course, I think they pay the most money. Both the start and the finish pay the most money to have the races in their start and finish in their towns, because that's where there's a lot larger gathering of people. So it's more profitable to them to do that. But so that's how the whole thing works as far as the free for everyone to watch goes. So it is free, but it's not free. So there's a lot of money spent. There's a lot of money made, just like any athletic event. There's definitely a lot of money involved in it. And it's very exciting. It's really, really cool to see. So there's going to be the big mountains are back. It's going to be the same as it has been over the years. We're going to have some enormous climbs in big, big mountains. It's just really an exciting time. I love it when it gets into the mountains. That's my favorite, because that's when all the tactics come out, or more of the tactics come out. I won't say all of them, because there are a tremendous amount of tactics when they're on the flatlands too. But it's when the grand tour leaders, or the tour captains, we'll call them, the team captains, are put to the test. And another thing that a lot of people don't understand about bicycle racing, it is very much, and our friend Amber Pierce and I talked about this a few weeks ago, it's very much a team race. All of the people that are on the team are working for one another. Each one has a specific job, and they usually have a number one person and a number two person in a grand tour that are the number one and number two contenders. You always have a backup plan. That would be the number two person, just in case the number one person has a terrible crash or has a health problem or something, then they always have a backup person to get in there. But then there are the rest of the people, and they are known as the domestiques. And the domestiques are the workers. Think of the queen bee versus the worker bees. And, you know, you've got the domestiques that are doing a lot of work, and they are as strong as some of those big riders are. They have a different job to do, and they have to accept the fact that that's their job and that's what they're paid to do. So often you'll see a domestique, you'll see the main rider up in the front with, you know, five or six other big riders from other teams, and they're all just kind of watching each other and, you know, paying attention and all. And that rider, one of the riders from the team, will actually slip back and go to the team car and fill up their pockets, which bicycle racers have pockets all over the back of their jerseys. Sometimes they'll even zip down the front of their jerseys, and they'll stuff all the bottles and food inside of their jerseys, and they'll zip it up nice and tight, and they'll carry it all up like a pack mule. And they'll hand out food to the other riders, so the other riders don't have to worry about having food passed up to them. And they take care of and feed their main riders and all the other riders too. And they take turns doing this. There'll be a couple of people that are actually designated as the domestiques to do the food for the day. And that's what they do. And so they're keeping the race going, and they're keeping the fuel inside of the riders, because these races are long. They're over 100 miles, a lot of them. And you think about, you know, 100 miles on a bicycle. Some people go, 100 miles on a bicycle? How in the world could you possibly ride 100 miles on a bicycle? And, well, that's a darn good question. How do you do that? Well, you do it by keeping the fuel in. You have to keep putting fuel in, because there is a point that you'll get to where you will just fade. I remember doing a number of races years ago where we had races that would go up to 100 miles, 80 miles, 90 miles, 100 miles that we were in. And you always knew the people who weren't eating, because at about 60 miles, they were gone. They would just drift off the back and they would be gone, because they just weren't putting enough fuel in. You've got to put the calories in, because you're just burning them like crazy. The average Tour de France rider burns between 8 and 10,000 calories a day. Think about that. Now, what I want you to do, here's your homework, is when you get done listening to the radio show or the podcast, I want you to sit down and try to figure out how much you would have to eat 8,000 calories. We'll start with the low end here. Just take a look at that and see what it would take. And I'm not talking about going to some junky fast food place where you have lots of empty calories that you're buying, which are certainly not good for you. I'm talking about healthy food. Sit down, figure it out. It's a lot of food. These guys eat like horses. They just eat and eat and eat and eat. And they're eating quality calories. They can't eat any junk. They do eat a lot of pasta-oriented things, lots of carbohydrates, because carbohydrates, they need the carbohydrates for the fuel. But it's it's really hard to imagine that. And oftentimes, even when Fran and I are out riding our bikes, we'll do a very long ride, and the next day we're just looking for food all day long because we didn't get enough food to replace the calories that we burned the day that we did the long ride. So you can go out and do like a 60 or 80 mile ride and just find yourself very hungry for 2 days afterwards because you're at a deficit and you're not able to replace the calories fast enough. So it's really fun to watch. I mean, these guys just sit down at these big, huge dinners at night, and they're just shoveling food in, just amazing amounts of food. It's just, you're just burning it so fast. And of course, when you're working that hard, your metabolism is also jacked a bit. So you're just always burning. Even when you're sitting still, you're burning calories. So it's a different crowd. It's a very different crowd, and you won't see anyone who is overweight riding in the Tour de France. Let's put it that way.
No.
Kind of like UPS drivers. You don't see those either.
Except on TV,
yeah. Where it's fictional. Yeah. Right, right.
Do you want to know what some of the Tour de France riders eat?
Sure.
So I've got the website up from Bon Appetit magazine, and there's a secret dietary weapon. Are you ready?
Sure.
Rice cakes.
Rice cakes.
Rice cakes. So watch carefully, and you'll see riders eating what look like tiny burritos wrapped in foil. Mm-hmm. And Team Sky, they particularly like to eat them. And he makes different rice cakes. They can be dense and they can be moist. They can be made of cooked rice, cream cheese, or almond butter, cinnamon, some agave syrup, you know, for a little extra sweetness.
Sure, sure.
The mixture is pressed into a pan and chilled, and then cut into squares and wrapped in foil. So it's not going to be the crunchy ones like you get at the store. It's like actual chewy rice, so it's nice and chewy. But it requires a minimum of chewing, and you just swallow it with a bit of water, and it's okay. And so he makes like a dozen flavors, and he rotates them. He makes apple and raisin, almond butter, banana, and he'll make different ones during a day because different riders have different preferences. So those are kind of a neat one to, you know, it's a neat thing to have. There's speculaas, which is a Dutch shortbread.
Okay.
Yeah, and there's some speculoos cookie butter, and speculoos is number one, and they also make Oreo.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah.
Anything to make it palatable so it'll go down easy, I'm sure.
Are you ready for this one? Mm-hmm. This is now the Cannondale team. Okay, so Cannondale makes overcooked rice with a little egg for protein. They have a sweet and sour one and one with bacon. And if a Cannondale rider really wants a sandwich, are you ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
They get one on gluten-free bread because Fowler, who is their, chef, he's had them on a gluten-moderate diet since 2009. He serves pasta only once or twice a week and makes his own gluten-free grains, and they've seen an improvement. And when you see a definite improvement, that's a lot because they're at a level most of us can't comprehend. And he's also experimenting with juicing. So the Cannondale team, they are gluten-mott, meaning they're not completely gluten-free, but they don't get a lot of gluten.
Well, there was a team a few years ago that did the same thing.
Yeah.
It was Garmin, Dr. Lee.
Alan Lim.
He put them on a gluten-free diet, and the reason he put them on a gluten-free diet was because he found that he was trying to reduce some of the inflammation in the riders because gluten and wheat will cause inflammation. And what he was getting out of it, he was getting better performance out of the riders and faster recoveries out of the riders. And they all objected to it because they wanted their pasta, you know, because pasta is something you just crave when you're doing stuff like this.
Yeah.
But he went to that direction and he got better performances and faster recoveries.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of science that goes into what these guys are eating.
The interesting thing about pasta, if you get einkorn pasta, if you're not celiac and you're not making inflammation because of einkorn, and you do eat a pasta, whether it's einkorn or rice, if you cook it and then you make like pasta salad, the point is you put it in the fridge. you get resistant starch. Mm-hmm. Resistant starch is good for people who are trying to lose weight, but it's also for people who want more staying power. So you're going to get more staying power from your pasta if you do pasta salad. Anyway, refrigerated pasta.
Right.
You cook the pasta and then you put it in the refrigerator.
Okay.
Because the starch becomes more resistant. It's just at the colder temperature, I just guess it congeals more. So it goes through your system slower. If it's going through your system slower, you're going to absorb it more slowly and you're just going, it's just going to last longer. You're going to get more, it's not going to get through you as fast. So you're actually going to be able to absorb more of the carbohydrates and use it. Chef Ore for the first team I said, which was the team that's doing the rice cakes, that's Sky, Team Sky. Mm-hmm. They are, they get rice pudding for dessert.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yum. That sounds great.
Okay.
So here you go. This is from a British Cycling Weekly.
Also coffee.
Oh, coffee too. Yeah. Gotta have coffee. I love my coffee. So 3 weeks, 21 stages, 535 kilometers, 198 cyclists, and a combined burn of 25 million calories. That's what they're burning, 25 million calories. That's a whole bunch of calories right there. Anyway, so, you know, these guys are just, they're just burning incredible, incredible amounts of food. Let's give you an idea here. From morning muesli to sundown shake, here's what a Tour de France rider can expect to eat each day of the race. 9 a.m. breakfast. Riders have their breakfast around 3 hours before the race. Carbohydrate-rich foods like bread, muesli, cereal, fruit, coffee, smoothies, orange juice, and even noodles help top off the glycogen stores. One thing riders avoid is eating heavy food. Okay, they have to resist the enticing pastries from hotel breakfast bars because that type of food just isn't easily and fully digested for the time of the start, making the riders' stomachs feel uncomfortably heavy.
That would be me.
Okay. 10:30, pre-race snack. Okay, so they've already had the breakfast, all this food for breakfast. Now, 10:30, pre-race snack.
Transfers
from hotels to stage starts can be long, offering an opportunity to top off carbohydrate, heart rate, and calories. Typically, rice cakes with honey, raisin bread, or a sports bar are consumed with fluid. Studies show tour riders are consuming less on the bike, possibly due to more aggressive racing, meaning greater reliance on pre- and post-race nutrition. 12 p.m. during the race. Different stages of the tour require different fueling strategies according to duration, intensity, and temperature. Fat metabolism can be utilized during mid-stage, low-intensity periods when a rider can shelter in the bunch and get towed along. In contrast, the tougher stages we'll see the body rely on carbohydrate, which means more gels and bars. Solid foods consumed on the bike include small rolls with jam, rice cakes and energy bars, like you had said earlier. Quick-to-consume gels, especially caffeinated ones, will provide a majority of calories as the pace increases and as the riders struggle to chew and swallow solids. Yeah, it's really hard to eat. Someone asked me once about eating on the bike and, you know, how can you eat when you're in a race? I don't understand how you can eat so much when you're in a race. And I said, well, I practice it. I train for it. And they said, how do you train to eat in a race? And I said, I eat when I'm climbing. So if I'm out on a training ride and I'm climbing up a hill, I eat and drink when I climb the hill. And by eating and drinking when I climb the hill, when you're breathing really hard, when you're working at a very high level, you're in zone four or you're pushing the pace a little bit. And if you can teach your body to do that in your training, then when you race, your body will accept the food when you're racing. And it's not easy. So anyway, the big alpine climbs, they expect riders to consume 6 electrolyte drinks, 3 energy bars, 2 isotonic gels, and a caffeine gel, more if the heat ramps up. So 17 hours post-race recovery, 1,700 hours post-race recovery. As soon as the stage ends, recovery begins. Recovery drinks with carbohydrate and 25 grams of protein are waiting for the riders as soon as they finish the stage, which they drink whilst cooling down. Depending on how long the transfer is, riders shower and change in the bus before eating a snack prepared by the team chef. Sandwiches, rich rice cakes, and cereal bars are standard fare. And then we get into the evening meal. Post-massage evening meals start with a salad, soup, or juice for nutrient boost, followed by meat or fish and carbohydrate-rich foods. But gone are the days of overcooked pasta. At the 2014 Tour de France, Garmin's chef Sean Fowler tweeted photos of flaxseed-crusted turkey and pumpkin soup, while Team Sky's Soren Christensen served up halibut with apple, peach, and fennel salsa. The aim is to use colorful foods to encourage riders to eat, because the last thing they want to do is to eat. They just want to go sleep. And to keep them nourished while avoiding food repetition, homemade cakes, yogurt, fruit, and flans are often served for dessert. So, and then lights out. Carbohydrate-rich snacks like small cakes, fruits, nuts and cereal ensure glycogen levels are constantly being topped off after dinner. Hydrogen is also an ongoing struggle, and it's rare to see a rider without a drink in their hand. So anyway, what happens if you try to eat like a Tour de France rider and their diet in one sitting? Well, not so good. You can't. You just can't put down that much food, and not comfortably, that's for sure. So they eat a lot. They eat a lot every single day. And you got to understand, these guys are they're machines. They're athletes. They're being taken care of. They have soigniers. They have people cooking their food for them. They have massage people. It's an entire entourage that goes along with this crew, and they're all being taken care of because they have to keep the motor running every single day, and they have to be fresh the next day. They have to be ready to go the next day. I really struggled to think that I could ride that many days in a row at that level. I just can't understand how they do it. But they train for it, obviously. They work really hard at it, and they train for it.
You're also a little older than they are.
Well, I am now, yeah. But I used to have dreams of this years ago.
You probably could have done it then in your 20s and 30s.
Yeah, and that's where they are.
Yeah.
They are. You know, an old Tour de France rider is in his late 30s.
Yeah.
And you'll occasionally see someone hit 40 and still be able to ride in a Grand Tour, but that's pretty rare.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're the peak age, I believe, is somewhere between 24 and 34.
Yeah.
And you see a couple of youngsters coming in right now. There's a whole bunch this year. They were talking about it last evening on the television, of younger riders that are in that, you know, 24 and 25 year range that are big time up and coming riders.
Lawson Craddock.
Yeah, Lawson Craddock. Yes.
Yes.
And Lawson is from?
He's from Texas.
He's from Texas.
Greater Houston.
Yeah, and they actually had him on last night after the race. It was kind of interesting to listen to him, and he looked like a little kid.
He looked like he was 19, but he's 24.
But he's 24, and he's a professional bicycle racer, and he raced for the Giant team for a couple of years, and now he's racing for the Cannondale team.
I'm going to follow him on Strava.
So, you know, these guys, it's not an easy life. It really is a very, very difficult thing to do. I will say, from not being anywhere near the level that these guys are, but from racing my bicycle for about 10 years, I can tell you that it is truly an exciting thing to do. It's really, really, like, there's adrenaline flow like you've never felt before. You get a real rush from it. Just a blast. It's like auto racing, except you are the motor. So think about that. You know, you're out racing just like you might be if you had some sort of a motorized vehicle, except you are the motorized vehicle. You're the one who's providing it all. So there's all these things you have to think about. You have to think about conserving the energy. You have to think about making sure you have enough fuel in the tank. You know, there's just so many things to focus on to keep you in the race. So anyway, it's Tour de France time. I'll be updating on the tour pretty much on a weekly basis here, hopefully, and we can kind of keep our eye on what's going on with the tour and where everybody stands. Right now, let's see what I have here. I believe that in the yellow jersey, the leader's jersey, I think we still have Peter Sagan, who is still there. I'm trying not to peek here because there's all sorts of things going on, so I have to stay away from this. But anyway, there's the leaders will bounce back and forth a bit, but today I think we're going to see a bit of a change because of the fact that there are some climbs that are involved today. It's probably going to separate a little bit out, and it's going to change the standings a bit. So we'll see what happens after the end of the day. But again, I am trying desperately not to peek, because that would be a bad idea. But anyway, moving on. So away from the Tour de France and going back into cycling in general and different things that we need to know about, we had an interesting weekend on the road. We went for a great ride on Saturday. I have to say, I think that ride was possibly the most courteous drivers, people in cars, let's say, ride that I have been on in a long time. We had a lot of people who were stopping for us, waving us through, helping us get across busy roads. I was really, really impressed with the cooperation that people in cars were giving the people on bikes this weekend. And that, to me, is very, very encouraging. So anyway, if you were out there and you saw a group of cyclists riding down the road and you were one of those people, I want to shout out to you. Thank you so much for being courteous to us. We really do appreciate it, as we are just people on bicycles. That's all. So thank you so, so much. Now, I believe that Fran went out for a ride the day after the weekend, and she had an encounter with a couple of people that weren't so courteous. Meaning that, and I do believe that was
yesterday,
a pickup truck incident or something.
I just encountered a few people who were impatient. This is an interesting point. I was attempting to make left turns, and when you make a left turn on a bicycle, of course, you're not like a car where you're taking up the whole lane and have a turn signal on. You really have to get over, and people don't understand that, you know, it's not safe for me to attempt to make a left turn from the shoulder. That I, just like you, I have to get to the midline to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I will sometimes, if it's safe to cross, I will cross the road a little bit before I get to the, you know, and maybe sometimes somewhat significantly before I get to the left turn.
Right.
And I will try like heck to keep my left arm out. But people don't understand that that's legal.
It's totally legal
and safe to do. And they get angry that I'm in the middle of the road. But what would you have me do? I can't cross the lane from the shoulder. That's not safe.
The problem is, if you try to cross from the shoulder, you're now crossing two different directions of traffic.
Yeah.
So it becomes far more dangerous to do that than it would to just become a vehicle on
right.
the road. So if you were a car, they would have no trouble with you. But because
right.
you're on a bicycle, they take the attitude of, you know,
you shouldn't be there.
You're in my way.
Right.
And no, we're not in your way. If we were a car, we wouldn't be in your way. We would just be a car in front of you. And that's it.
And right. And you can pass me to my right if
absolutely.
You want to.
And
I just stay as far as I can. That's the thing. If I'm going to turn left, I'm going to stay as close as I can to the midline.
Right.
And I'm going to hold my arm out so you know I'm about to turn left.
And the idea of that is to give the person in the car the room to come around
right.
you on the right. So
and sometimes you can't keep your arm out because you have to pilot your bike for a second.
Well, you have to use your brakes.
Right. You have to use your brakes sometimes.
One of
so guess
hands
what?
Is a brake.
Be careful out there, because sometimes there will be a bicycle in the middle of the road. And the reason that they're there is because they're attempting to make a turn and they want to hold their arm up, but they can't always do that. So instead of becoming enraged, take a breath. Life isn't that bad. That cyclist is not there to mess you up. That cyclist is there because they are on a bike ride and they're getting exercise, or they're getting from here to there and they're about to take a left turn. They're not there to make your life worse.
Right, right. And 10 seconds out of your day is not a lot to ask.
So it's much safer for you to not become enraged and to see it, oh, there is an obstacle in the road. I need to be careful. There are obstacles in the road anyway. There's other cars. What happened to us when we were climbing to Yukon today in our cars? We got behind a cement truck. What were we going to do? There was a parade behind the cement truck.
Absolutely.
What are you going to do?
And we went the speed of the cement truck.
Before I did that,
there was a tractor on Bassett's Bridge Road that was mowing the road.
Right.
So he was in a position where I couldn't really see around him when I got to him. So I just stopped and I waited.
And when he got
further forward to the point where I could be able to see around him, I went around him.
Slowly.
Yes.
You crawled around him.
I did.
Yes.
And that's the right way to do it. And it is not correct to pass that cyclist when there is a car coming the other way.
No.
You need to
wait
your turn, just like you would if it were the tractor mowing the road or the cement truck going down the road.
And I'm saying, even if you don't like the fact that cyclists are on the road, they're on the road. They're allowed to be there. Not only are they allowed to be there, there are laws dictating how they are allowed to be there that you have to follow. And you becoming enraged puts you into high blood pressure, puts you into anxiety, puts you closer to your own death. And if you hurt or kill that cyclist, you're going to jail. So figure out how to be calmer about cyclists on the road. And even better, go ride a bicycle yourself.
Take a deep breath. Breathe.
The cyclists are there and they're not going away. And if you do something illegal, I mean, first of all, your rage is bad for you. It's bad for the cyclist, but it's bad for you and it's bad for all the cars around you. And it could make you do something that could ruin your life.
Exactly.
So if you take the rage out of the picture, you're going to make more rational decisions. If you accept that person exists and is there and is simply riding their bicycle, it's a lot better for everyone. It's a lot better for you.
So moving on from that, segueing from that, I am on the website of bikeleague.org, which is the League of American Bicyclists. And there is a section that is entitled State Bike Laws. And you can click down and you can find your state on there and you can take a look and you can see what your laws are for the state, which is very nice. Starting with, and I am, of course, in Connecticut, so I am going to talk about Connecticut here. And safe passing laws. Connecticut provides the driver of the vehicle overtaking another vehicle proceeding in the same direction shall pass to the left thereof at a safe distance and shall not again drive to the right side of the highway until safely clear of the overtaken vehicle. Note that these are mentioned as vehicles, not bicycles. Because a bicycle is a vehicle. A safe distance means not less than 3 feet when the driver of the vehicle overtakes and passes a person riding a bicycle. Helmet law. Connecticut requires that any person 15 years of age or under riding a bicycle as an operator or passenger must wear a protective bicycle helmet. However, failure to wear a protective bicycle helmet as required shall not be considered to be contributory negligence on the part of the parent or the child, nor shall such failure be admissible in any civil action. Although I do know that there are children who have been given a citation or their parents have been given a citation for not having a helmet on their child. And if they basically all they have to do is buy the helmet, bring the receipt, turn it in, and the fine goes away. But they do get a fine for it. So that's the way that Connecticut deals with it, as far as I know. So we also have a Share the Road license plate program here, which is nice because it goes back to helping out with bicycle safety in the state of Connecticut. Then there's something called vulnerable road user laws. Connecticut defines vulnerable user as a pedestrian, a highway worker, a person riding or driving an animal, a person riding a bicycle, a person using a skateboard, roller skates, or inline skates, a person operating or riding on an agricultural tractor, a person using a wheelchair or motorized chair, or a blind person and such person's service animal. So Connecticut provides protection to vulnerable users by providing that any person operating a motor vehicle on a public way who fails to exercise reasonable care and causes the serious physical injury or death of the vulnerable user of a public way, provided such vulnerable user has shown reasonable care in such user's use of the public way, shall be fined not more than $1,000. Good Lord. So you can kill someone and pay $1,000 for it. Boy, that just really is not right. So we won't get into the difference between driving a 6,000-pound vehicle and operating a firearm and killing someone and the differences between the penalties here. I'll try not to rant too much on that. Maybe I'll save that for another show. Connecticut also has several statutes aimed at protecting bicyclists. Specifically, these include no person operating a vehicle that overtakes and passes a person riding a bicycle proceeding in the same direction shall make a right turn unless the turn can be made with reasonable safety and will not impede the travel of a person riding a bicycle. Let's explore this just for a second. So if you're coming up behind a person on a bicycle, okay, and you're a person driving a car, and 200 or 300 yards up the road, you are planning on making a right-hand turn into either your local shopping center or the road that you're planning on turning on, just wait. Please just wait. That's all. You know, it's going to cost you 10, maybe 15 seconds. That's it. Wait until you get there, then turn. I have people do this all the time where they will wait, and I'll hear them coming up behind me, and I'll look back, and I'll see them there, and I'll see their signal on, and they will wait to turn, and just before they turn, I always give them a friendly wave because they were considerate, and that's all it takes. It's really, really simple. A surcharge shall be imposed equivalent to 100% of a fine established or imposed for the violation of certain laws regulating the right-of-way of intersections when a driver of a vehicle fails to grant or yield the right-of-way to a person riding a bicycle. So if you do that, if you actually go around someone and then cut them off, there is a major fine involved with that. If there happens to be a police officer at that corner and you get caught, you're going to be in big trouble. You're definitely going to be in big trouble. So, you know, just think about it. That's all. Think about it. It's life is not that short where you have to be going that fast all the time. So there are also distracted driving laws. Here's a big one. Okay, how many of you out there are distracted drivers? I've been a distracted driver. I drive a car. I drive a vehicle. And I can say that it's very easy to be distracted. I actually think that some of the vehicles that we're producing today are designed to cause distraction because of all the digital screens that we have all over our cars, which are not necessarily in our field of view when we're driving our cars down the road. So that's yet another gripe for probably another time. But let's talk about this distracted driving thing because it's a big, big deal. It, by the way, distracted driving is equal to, what did they say, 3 beers? I think that's what it is. A distracted driver or person on a cell phone is about as good at driving their vehicle as someone who has wolfed down 3 beers. And I'm not talking about had 3 beers over a couple hours period of time. I'm talking about drink a beer, drink a beer, drink a beer. So that just gives you an idea of just how tough it is when you're a distracted driver. So no person should operate a vehicle upon a highway while using a handheld mobile phone to engage in a call or using a mobile electronic device when such vehicle is in motion. Get that, folks? Please put down your cell phones. Please, please, please put down your cell phones. Put it on a holder in the car at least. At least don't hold it. Use the hands-free mechanism. Please. I scared the living daylights out of a woman last year. I was turning onto Bassett's Bridge Road from North Windham, and I was turning onto the road, and I had just come across the bridge, and this woman did a classic rolling stop, so she didn't stop at the stop sign, and she drove through, and she was turning onto the bridge as I was coming through, and she was yapping away on her phone, and she had her window wide open. Well, when she went by me, I was probably, because I was not at the very edge of the road, I was probably no more than 3 feet from her face, and I yelled to her very quickly, "Put down the phone," and I scared the daylights out of her, because she didn't see me. She never saw me, so she wasn't expecting me to be there, and I startled her, and I hope I startled her to the point where she won't do that anymore, but we can only hope. I doubt it happened, but anyway, put down the phone, please. Just put down the phone. You don't need to be on the phone all the time. You really don't. You need to be driving your vehicle. An operator of a motor vehicle may not type, send, or text message or read a text message with a handheld mobile telephone or a mobile electronic device while the vehicle's in motion. These are the laws in the state of Connecticut. This is it. No person shall use a handheld mobile telephone or electronic device, including those with hands-free accessories or a mobile electronic device, while operating a moving school bus. Get that? If you drive a bus, please don't use your cell phone. Not to mention, we won't even get into the can of worms that'll open. No person under 18 years of age shall use any handheld mobile telephone, including one with hands-free accessories or a mobile electronic device, while operating a moving vehicle on a public highway. If you're 18 years or younger in the state of Connecticut, you're not allowed to use it. So that's a big deal. That's a real big deal. So anyway, there's a list of things here, lots of different rules. Some of the things like where to ride, 3 foot rule on the side of the road. The fact that the cyclist has the cyclist is in charge of the decision to ride as far to the right as safely possible, not the motor vehicle. So remember, if you're a person in a car or a truck, you do not have the right to tell that rider how far to the right they can drive. They can ride their bicycle. That is their responsibility, not yours. So please don't teach us what you don't know, because that's really important. We had a discussion a number of weeks ago where I asked a driver who was screaming at us because we were on the road, just for no very other reason than the fact that we were on the road. And unfortunately, they didn't realize that there was a red light ahead and that they were going to have to stop at that red light, and they couldn't get through. And so it gave me a chance to tap on their window and have a discussion with them. And they continued to scream at me as the window came down. And I said, please pull over and let's talk about bicycle law. I would love to talk to you about bicycle law, because people don't know. They just really don't know. So anyway, that's the next thing on the list here is sidewalk riding. Okay. Connecticut allows bicycles to operate on sidewalks subject to the following rules. Each person operating a bicycle along a sidewalk or across any roadway upon and along a crosswalk shall yield the right-of-way to any pedestrian or shall give audible signal with reasonable distance before overtaking and passing the pedestrian. And no person shall operate a bicycle upon or along a sidewalk or across a roadway and upon and along a crosswalk if such operation is prohibited by any ordinance of any city, town, or borough, or by any regulation of the State Traffic Commission. So here's the deal. Check with your town and see if they allow you to ride on the sidewalk. 9 times out of 10, they will say no. It is not legal to ride on the sidewalk. Sidewalks are made for pedestrians. So you want to keep pedestrians safe. Don't ride your bicycle there. Big shout out to students on UConn campus. Please don't ride on the sidewalk. It drives me nuts. I almost get run over by bicycles all the time on this campus. And it's dangerous to ride your bicycle on the sidewalk. And there's never an announcement because they're usually plugged in. They've got headphones on or earbuds or whatever it is. And they just aren't paying attention. So if you are going to ride on the sidewalk, ride at a speed that would be similar to that of the people who are walking on the sidewalk. If that's too slow for you, please get out in the road where vehicles belong. So there's a simple thing. Makes a lot of sense. Seems like common sense, but it's something that you need to be aware of. Bicycling under the influence. Yes, you should not be bicycling under the influence, just like you shouldn't be driving a vehicle under the influence. Seems simple, doesn't it? But bicycles should not be operated while intoxicated, and operating a bicycle while under the influence of alcohol or other controlled substances may result in severe punishments. Hello. Connecticut, now this one I thought was really interesting. Connecticut does not provide any modifications to the requirement to come to a complete stop when directed to stop by traffic control devices and does not authorize bicycles to disobey traffic lights that fail to detect bicycles. So if you are on a bicycle and you get to a tripped light and it won't trip for you because it doesn't recognize you, you can't run that light.
So what do you do?
That's well, and there we have the question. And that's a law.
What if there's no, what if you're on a country road and it just won't, you know,
and,
what?
And you know what? You know what? It's illegal. You're going to do it, okay. But it's illegal.
Okay.
But I'm just letting you know that it is
illegal. It is
illegal. Is illegal.
Right.
Yes, it is. I saw that and I just started laughing when I saw that when I was reading this earlier today. And it's like, oh my God, you got to be kidding me.
Well, if the world were more bicycle friendly, there would be buttons on those. So some of the lights have buttons on them that, you know, that will allow you to cross. So,
right.
Like the intersection at Chewink Road, crossing over to 198, there's a button there.
Right.
You know, and then Lynch Road, there's a button there.
Right.
So there, and those are classic places where those are classic places where it's hard to trip the light.
Right. Right. A couple quickies here. Dooring law. No law was found in Connecticut that requires persons opening a door of a motor vehicle to do so in a reasonably safe manner. That does not interfere with the movement of traffic. So if you open your door into a bicycle and they hit you, surprise. And if you open your door into a moving vehicle of other type, maybe a truck or a car, say goodbye to your door and you're responsible for it. Oops. It does, however, caution drivers when parked on the street to look to the side and rear for bicycles before opening their vehicle door. One thing I can give you as a tip for cyclists, always look, if you're in a parallel parked area, always look at the driver's side mirror because you can see a driver in the seat of the car through the mirror. So that's just a little bit of a tip, just so that you're aware. Anyway, there are other resources here that you can look at, and they are all stated on the Bike Walk Connecticut. That's www.bikewalkct.org, and you'll find even more information there and resources there. Great organization. They're here to help give us more legislation that is focused more on cycling and pedestrian use here in the state of Connecticut. And so there is a great source for you. That pretty much wraps us up. We've covered the Tour de France. We've talked a little bit about bicycle law. We can talk about bicycle law until we're blue in the face. I can see that it'll probably be a subject all the time. I would like to thank you for listening to Bicycle Talk here on WHUS with co-host Fran Storch, where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, and bicycle business. Have a safe and wonderful day where every day is a great day to ride your bike.